Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa. A decade and a half ago, I received an inquiry from an undergraduate student at Yale University. She was learning Russian and wanted to come to northern Alberta to spend the summer doing field research in the Old Believer community near Athabasca. I had first met this community in the 1970s, shortly after their arrival. A bit later, I spent some time with my colleague, the anthropologist David Scheffel, who was the first one to do field research in this community and publish a book about it. This community has its origins in Siberia, to which their ancestors had been exiled following the reforms introduced to the Russian Orthodox Church by Patriarch Nikon in 1666. Some of them made their way into the remote regions of China, lived a reclusive life, and occasionally hunted Siberian tigers for European zoos. In order to avoid the reach of the communist government in China, in the 1960s, they moved again and eventually settled in Canada. It was not the sort of community I would readily suggest a young woman, or a young man for that matter, to endeavor to engage. I called the phone number on the correspondence and met Molly Worthen. She spoke easily about herself and her interests, mentioned growing up in Chicago, the city that entered my blood when I studied there in the 1960s. It was clear to me that she had the intellectual curiosity and formation, the spirit of hospitality, and simple good judgment and determination suitable to the work that she proposed. Over the summer, we got to know each other, and her work in the Old Believer community flourished. That summer played a little role in Molly focusing her work on North American religious and intellectual history, particularly the ideas and culture of conservative Christianity. She is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and director of the Honors Program there. She's also an opinion writer for the New York Times, Slate, and other publications. Her superb book, Apostles of Reason, The Crisis of Authority in American Evangelicalism, explores the intellectual history of American evangelicals and the cultural wars since 1945. I welcome you to our conversation on President Trump, the evangelicals, and what is unfolding in American political culture.
Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa.
Molly, we have not seen each other for 10 years. Shocking moment.
It is.
And in that time, you've published several marvelous books and what have you. And you've been doing a good deal of work on the evangelical communities in the United States, as well as thinking about them here in Canada as well. Its relationship to politics and the President Trump has sort of raised this in the public mind again. I would like to begin, though, by asking you, as a historian with the long view, what do you see as some of the gifts of the evangelical world in the United States? Whether those are vividly present now or not, how does it look to you when one looks back over time and begins to pick out what the fruitful things were within those communities?
When I began studying the evangelical tradition, I was immediately faced with the challenge of how to define this tradition, which is one that scholars and believers alike, you know, can argue endlessly about whether there is a there, whether there is something we can talk about as an evangelical tradition. There is so much disagreement among these different churches we might lump together with that label on even what perhaps we could call fundamental matters like the conversion experience and so forth. It's very hard to get your arms around it. And in the end, I settled on a decision to think of this tradition as not united by a clear set of doctrinal bullet points, but rather a set of questions that they all wrestle with. anyone I would want to corral with this label, whether they are peace witnessing Mennonites or holy rolling Pentecostals. I think they all come out of
this. Or those that have the second blessing.
Or those that have the second blessing. They all come out of a common tradition that has its roots in the particular ferment of spiritual and intellectual and religious issues in the kind of generations after the Reformation. And they all, they orbit around really problems of authority. And what I mean by that is, I think that the people I call evangelical wrestle very deeply with how to have a true relationship with God. You know, they might describe that as how to meet and know Jesus. They wrestle with the fracture between faith and reason and how to be serious modern thinking humans while also giving credence to this very high view of the authority of Scripture and so forth. And thirdly, they wrestle with how to reconcile one's personal faith with the demands of a increasingly pluralistic and secular public. And I think these are really, in some sense, they are peculiarly evangelical versions of the questions of Western modernity. I mean, we all are yanked in different directions by authorities and loyalties that have their claims on us that often conflict. And what I admire about evangelicals, at their best, is that they are one of the few groups that seems to confront these conundrums in a sincere, quite energetic way. And I think that sometimes those of us who are in different traditions where we tell ourselves the matter of authority is clearer, whether it's those who would call ourselves secular liberals, whether you are a pious Roman Catholic, you have some authority that you turn to most of the time that seems to trump the others. Really, in fact, if you really thought about it, and you thought about your own tradition, and you thought about the range of views in your own community, you would see that you exist in a state of cognitive dissonance. Now, in practice, I think evangelicals, some of their worst intellectual and political habits come out of the anxieties that grow from these paradoxes, these problems, these multiple authorities and rending their souls, so to speak. But I think beneath that is this really sincere grappling with what it is to be a human being in the modern world.
I think in the past I may have mentioned to you growing up in my parents' home, and my parents were both Lutheran, but deeply evangelical. And as a little boy, to sit till 4 a.m. listening to my father and various people that would come over and wrestle with these problems. And that wrestling was so passionately done. You know, in my home, you could only really talk about theology and politics. My father would pick up his Bible and start reading it if you wanted to go someplace else. He had no time for speaking about the weather. So I appreciate the way you have seen that and how you look at that whole set of things, that whole set of communities, really, and those particular themes that cross those boundaries. So the relationship to modernity, this is a, in a sense, do you see the evangelical tradition as being both a response to our form of modernity as well as born out of it?
I think evangelical Christianity is in some ways the most deeply tied to the features of Western modernity of any of the Christian traditions, which can seem like an odd thing to say, and I would include in that the so-called fundamentalists who seem to so strenuously reject features of modernity. And I don't think it's any secret to suggest that that all fundamentalists are, they would not exist without modernity. They're responding to it in some way, but they're also shaped by it. I mean, I think as humans, we are always, we're shaped by our interlocutors and our antagonists. And while, you know, you can certainly trace important roots of particular evangelical ideas and worship practices, ways of being in the world, far into the deep past of their tradition to the very beginning, to the apostles. So much of what characterizes their relationship with Scripture, for example, their relationship with the state, really is a product of the particular dynamics of European public and intellectual life in the generations immediately following the Protestant Reformation. I think that this came home to me most clearly in learning about the history of evangelical ideas about the Bible, particularly this concept of biblical inerrancy, the perfection of Scripture. Because on the one hand, of course, this is a very ancient idea, the idea that the Bible is a perfect source of truth. Christians have been concerned to assert that against all manner of heterodox interpretations and heretics going back to the beginning. You can read Bishop Irenaeus, you know, writing against the Gnostics and so forth. But in the 17th century, you know, a couple generations after the start of the Reformation, you see a set of Protestant theologians really wrestling with a particular set of antagonists. On the one hand, they were very concerned about efforts by Catholic theologians to dismantle Protestant claims to authority using the relentless logic of scholastic theology. They were also facing the heralds of the scientific revolution a bit later, thinkers of the Enlightenment, who were using other methods to explore God's creation that had not very much to do with God directly, who were in some cases quite consciously trying to debunk the miraculous claims of the Gospels and so forth. And these theologians really felt the burden to respond to science and philosophy on its own terms. And they took this ancient kernel, this idea that the Bible should be trustworthy, that it is God-breathed, and they clothed it in Western rationalistic, you know, pseudo-scientific garb. And that's very different, I think, from what even the first Protestant reformers, people like Martin Luther and John Calvin, were up to. They were very worried about defending the authority of the Bible, but in a broader sense. And, you know, Luther famously was comfortable picking and choosing, prioritizing his canon, dismissing, you know, the Epistle of James as the Epistle of Straw and all of that. And the tradition of biblical interpretation that has really become very, very dominant, particularly in American evangelicalism, draws its ideas of truth and trustworthiness and perfection from this moment in history, which really swung the practice of interpreting the Bible toward this idea that we should see our Bible as a science or a history textbook, that it must be reliable not solely in matters pertaining to salvation, but in the tiniest, you know, granular details of ancient Israel's politics and all that. And there have been other dissenting schools of biblical interpretation within evangelicalism, but this sort of pseudoscientific one is a good example of the deeply modern Western character of much of evangelical intellectual life.
I've known so many people for whom that is their approach to the Scripture. And that's where they usually make all their arguments, at least their arguments which are based on trying to counter what they understand the liberal tradition to be or secular perspectives to be. I recall one time here, not all that long ago, saying to a gentleman in my church who actually grew up Anglican and now worships in an Orthodox church, but who has been deeply tied to the evangelical world, particularly around politics. I remember him making these arguments about the facts of the Bible, the historical facts of the Bible. And I listened to him for some time and queried it a little bit. And then I said to him, so has anybody ever been saved by believing in the historical facts of the Bible. Is that the source of salvation for them? So it's a curious phenomenon.
Well, what did he, surely he said no. Did he say no?
He was ambiguous about it.
Huh.
The question had not arisen for him, which I think is often the case. But that's because, or at least my sense is, and I'm interested in yours, my sense is that so many of these people have positioned themselves in opposition to what they see as particular strains of thought and ethical understanding and politics in our world. If one finds a way to talk with them, to have conversation with them, which doesn't come through the prism of this kind of apology, does one have a different conversation? Let me say a little more about that. I'm interested, and I know you are as well, and work in this area. I'm very interested in hearing how people actually understand their life in the world, understand their faith. With evangelicals, it seems to me, most of the public conversation is always around these oppositional issues, around a set of single issues. You know, there's a half a dozen of them, whether it's evolution or abortion or across the map, where there's the frame of that conversation is oppositional and picks up on those issues of authority in the scripture that you've highlighted. But what I have also found, since I've done a bit of work with some people that certainly define themselves as fundamentalists, if one doesn't approach it through that prism, but I can recall a couple of examples in my life where I asked them a bit about their own encounter with Jesus Christ, for example. How did you meet Jesus? And, or around a particular biblical narrative that they treasure, and then explore that narrative, explore their experience. One gets a different conversation, quite a different conversation, a conversation that has a lot more to do with their existential experience, a conversation which often makes, at least to my eye, more vivid their capacity for compassion, why they do some of the kind of charitable things they do. So I was wondering, have you found that as well in the approach, in how one approaches it? Because you've been talking with various evangelicals for some time now in your work. Do you find that there's, I'm not sure how to put this, I sometimes say there's a kind of spiritual schizophrenia that exists, which is the public face of it, which gets so much attention. But then there's this other face, which has to do with their sense of the spiritual life. To my mind, it's like two entirely different conversations.
Hmm. I very much recognize what you're describing. And I think I've done a lot of my recent journalistic work has been at the point where those two conversations intersect. I'm very interested in younger evangelicals who come from conservative, majority white churches, very formed by the moral majority attitude toward cultural change. But these are young people who are really trying to figure out their own views on these things and are struggling. And it's been interesting to talk with them about the process of theological evolution in their own minds. For example, I spoke a few months ago to a young woman who was finishing up her time as a student at Biola University, a prominent evangelical university outside of Los Angeles. I know you've been there.
I've been there.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. It's generally pretty conservative. She was an editor at the campus newspaper. I had found her because some of what she'd written tipped me off that she was maybe dissenting a little bit from the party line as it's perceived.
And Biola is such an interesting place in the
it
sense.
It is.
Because the two oil millionaires that funded
the, Stewarts,
the publication
yeah.
of the Fundamentals mm-hmm. also funded Biola.
Of course, yes. And yes, there are many strains of evangelicalism, mm-hmm. you know, kind of in the mix there. It's very, it's not majority white anymore. It's an unusual institution in that because it's decided to really make a point of serving its community. I think about half the students are non-white, and a huge proportion of them are Latino and so forth. So it's a more diverse environment than maybe you might expect when you kind of imagine an evangelical college in your head. At any rate, this young woman said that when she got there, you know, she was a very typical 18-year-old, and that, you know, if you'd quizzed her on her theological opinions, she would have parroted whatever she heard in her parents' church, but she didn't give it a whole lot of thought. She was mainly focused on, you know, what boys were in her class and that kind of thing. And then she began developing relationships with people who didn't fit in her inherited Christian boxes. She became friends with, you know, gay classmates, you know, non-American classmates who, you know, came from a national political setting where the relationship between politics and religion and the need for socioeconomic justice was maybe cast in different terms than she'd encountered here. She started having encounters with older women mentors that got her thinking about the question of women in leadership. And it was really these relationships first, rather than a key sermon she heard, a book she encountered, a personal internal spiritual experience. It was the relationships that planted the bug of beginning to question and change her mind. And then she turned to the resources of the church. Often she found, you know, books with titles like Jesus Feminist. She raised these questions at her Bible study. She started using those intellectual tools to articulate what her gut was telling her. Gut was telling her, I have to revise my view of homosexuality, or I'm not buying complementarian rules about, you know, where women belong in the church. I need to rethink the scripture. Now, I think the trouble that young Christians like her have run into is that if they then enter a liberal Christian context and try to have these conversations, they can't. So I talked to another young woman who went through a similar journey as a student at Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. And then she went to be gone to do a master's degree at Princeton Theological Seminary, which is now a fairly liberal place. And she described to me trying to just have a serious conversation about the Bible and homosexual sex and really wrestle with first chapter of Romans. And to even raise that question was offensive to liberals who had already long ago moved past it, you know, rejected this way of taking the Bible, quote, literally. And so she felt, you know, here I am in the middle, and I just see these two conversations talking past one another. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that personal focusing on people's kind of personal relationships with scripture and religious authority does give you a whole different vision. But it also can reveal some of the intractability of this in politics.
So what you've described, speaking about this young woman, is the way in which these two worlds begin to collide, and within somebody who's pious, who is part of the community, they're trying to sort it out and come to a new understanding without jettisoning their community.
Right.
It's a tough thing. It's very tough. I know that here in Canada, a lot of the family foundations that exist within the evangelical world fund a variety of things. They're passing to the younger generation. And I've met a number of those people. And I have seen them engaged in this kind of both intellectual and spiritual struggle around these issues which have been have gotten so much attention in the public realm associated with evangelicals. But it is a real struggle. I think sometimes, Molly, that the evangelical world, this is maybe scandalous to say, the evangelical world strikes me these days a little bit like the Muslim world strikes me. That there is an enormous, you know, there's all the geopolitical issues, and there are many layers to this, as there is in the evangelical world. But also, one of the things that is taking place is a real struggle for the soul of the tradition. Who's going to define how we understand Islam? Who's going to define how we understand evangelicalism? So you've recently spent time with younger people that are trying to understand evangelical world in a somewhat different way, and you've talked with several noted scholars in this area as well, who are authors, the author of the Benedict Option, for example, and others. So certainly in the media, there was a little bit of a sense of shock that, according to the surveys, such a high percentage of evangelicals supported the election of President Trump. I know during the run-up to the election, I made arguments with my good liberal friends. I said, just hold on. Don't assume that all the evangelicals are going to jump on this bandwagon. And then in the end, it was remarkable, the percentages that voted for him.
Right. 81% of those who voted, who identify as white evangelical, supported him.
So what is your sense of the pull there? And also of how they are understanding President Trump, particularly in light of the many things that obviously they would see as immoral, things that they wouldn't otherwise be at all sympathetic to. So how are they putting that together?
I was certainly not, I did not predict the election of Donald Trump, but since he was elected, I have thought back over evangelical history and realized how completely unsurprising it is. And so many more of us should have seen that this would happen. I mean, there are a few straightforward points to make off the top. The first is that evangelicals have never been political idealists. You can go back to the earliest chapters of the history of the United States and find them making alliances with infidels, people like Thomas Jefferson, because they agreed, you know, the Baptists of Virginia agreed with Jefferson on the matter of religious freedom, even if, you know, Jefferson snipped out all the miracles from his copy of the New Testament, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, Trump, of course, achieves a new, to my mind, possibly unprecedented degree of sociopathic, amoral conduct. I don't think there's any precedent in the history of American leadership that comes close. So this is a new level of compromise with someone who doesn't personally share your values. But I think it becomes legible to us when we think of even that group we're calling conservative white evangelicals as not a monolith, but people who supported Trump for a number of reasons. I have certainly talked to some for whom this was a very straightforward matter of the tactical move that would most likely result in the limitation of access to abortion and perhaps the banning of it entirely. And there, I would say this is a minority, but that these are evangelicals for whom this is a matter of stopping genocide. Mm-hmm. And I take those people very seriously. And right. I think secular liberals are far too quick to dismiss that and to dismiss the gravity of it for people for whom this is really a single issue. Now, that has a whole history. It hasn't always been the case that evangelicals were so focused on that issue or understood abortion as they do now. But that's maybe a separate question. The second point I would make, the second category perhaps, are people for whom evangelical doesn't mean they go to church every Sunday and have a clear sense of a denominational identity and carry around a highlighted, beat-up copy of the scriptures. There are a lot of people, and this is a growing number, and I'm sure it's true in Canada too, for whom evangelical has become a kind of cultural marker. You know, maybe they have some Christian history in their family. Maybe their parents went to church. They haven't been themselves in a long time. Very low levels of religious literacy. And to call themselves evangelical when the pollster calls them up and asks is to say, I am a native-born Christian American, and people who aren't like me are jumping the line. They're getting ahead in the queue for success and opportunity, and it's a rotten deal, and my country is being taken away from me. And they're reacting to real demographic trends far more than is the case in Canada. For a long time, white Protestant men, were really able to be quite comfortable and complacent about their cultural hegemony. We didn't have a big Catholic minority. You know, we exterminated a far higher proportion of our indigenous population than Canadians did. And so it was really only in the 60s and 70s, and more recently in some communities, where that the fraying of that and the erosion of that authority became quite evident. Of course, intersecting with trends in globalization and economic changes as well. So for those people, Donald Trump's message of making America great again, his xenophobia, resonated deeply, and they frankly weren't particularly hung up on the Christian piece of it. But, and that's something that, you know, when I spoke to evangelical leaders in the lead up to the election, shortly after it, the handful of outspoken opponents to Donald Trump who are in the evangelical leadership, they would often try to make the claim that if you look at some studies that correlate church attendance with voting, the so-called evangelicals who voted for Trump, well, they're not real evangelicals because they don't go to church. Now, first of all, evangelicals decided to not have a pope, right? So they don't really get to decide who counts. But secondly, subsequent social science data has actually contradicted that. And Donald Trump's support is still very high among church-going white evangelicals. So, you know, I think that he really advanced a narrative of gender hierarchy and kind of putting women in their place that assuaged long-standing anxieties felt by white evangelical men, part of a bigger cultural picture, but also particular to the conservative Christian tradition and some of the agonies about the role of women in that environment. I think there's a strain of leadership in especially American evangelical culture, though you can maybe point to some Canadian examples, of the kind of fundamentalist, unaccountable warlord who has his feudal fiefdom and no one can mess with him. And there's a way in which Trump's leadership style mapped on to something a bit familiar for evangelicals. And the last important point I would add is that Donald Trump built his success not just by offering an ideology, but by offering an alternative universe of claimed facts. He's a reality television star, right? He constructed a reality in which everything you read in the New York Times is fake news. And this is a major part of why he's been successful. And his denigration of secular expertise is something that evangelicals have been doing in their own world for a very, very long time. You know, ever since the rise of the higher biblical critics in the second half of the 19th century, they've been calling secular experts purveyors of fake news. And I've spent some time studying a particular school of theological thought that developed, well, has Dutch Reformed roots, but it really developed in America in the early 20th century, that focuses very much on exposing the faulty assumptions underlying the secular humanist worldview. And once you see that your opponent is coming from faulty assumptions and does not premise their whole view of reality on the inerrant truth of the Bible, you don't even have to take the argument seriously. You can just dismiss it out of hand. So when Donald Trump came along and began doing that, he was speaking to a tradition of thought that's very robust in the evangelical world. So I think those are a few of the pieces that help this make sense.
Another aspect of it that has struck me is this, the way in which evangelicals have, of course, a strong sense of human sin and the presence of evil in the world. And one of the finest things to my mind about evangelicals is that they're open to the sinner undergoing some process of redemption and conversion. So I've wondered if, in looking at President Trump, many of these people don't simply say to themselves, of course he did all these things, he's that kind of a person. But you know, he doesn't speak about it, but maybe there's been some kind of transformation here. So very open to the kind of cathartic way in which much of evangelicalism sees the process of redemption. That on the one hand, and then on the other hand, the way they read scripture, and it's not simply evangelicals that have done this, of course, there's Jews that do this as well, where you can also see the leader who is an infidel. You see him as also doing God's work.
Right, right. God used the Canaanites to right. discipline the ancient Israelites. Yes, I've encountered that line of argument.
And Babylon mm-hmm. and what have you. In some of my work within the Muslim community, I have asked some scholars about how they understand the caliph, how they understand the sultan, and what their expectations are in their understanding of Islam. What are their moral expectations of leadership? And here I've seen another parallel with the recent story in the United States. They've all said to me, the caliph, the sultan, all that Islam requires of this person is that they institute and see that there's a certain kind of public veracity around Sharia law. We don't expect them mm-hmm. to be part of that. If they do that, that's what their leadership responsibility is. We're not asking them to live up to any moral standard.
Absolutely. And from that point of view, and this is a simple but important point, Donald Trump has been the best president for the American religious right that conservative white evangelicals have ever had. I mean, it was from purely the standpoint of acting on the platform of the Christian right, this was an excellent political deal they made, and it has more than repaid itself in, you know, the Supreme Court, in his appointment of conservatives to our federal system, in you know, the steps he's taken to roll back public acceptance and legal protections for gay and transgender people, on all of these points, I think from the standpoint of evangelical leaders, he has done exactly as you describe. I mean, he has his own personal failings, but he has carried out this mission with a great deal more consistency than even someone like George W. Bush, you know, the evangelical American president par excellence.
Or Jimmy Carter.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Jimmy Carter was a source of great disillusionment for so many white evangelicals, and his progressive big government policies encouraged many of them to make the jump to the Republicans, and they've never looked back.
So how come, or is it the case, that the Democratic Party, the intellectual leadership and political leadership in the more center of the political spectrum and the left, my sense is that they have yet to understand this. They don't really see what's happened here or understand why it has the traction it has. What's your sense of this? You know this so much better than I.
I think that everything I have said about the broad shape of conservative evangelicals' alliance with Donald Trump, they would say, yes, that makes sense. What they often fail to see is the role of the American left's own radicalization on certain issues and their own internecine squabbles and confused priorities, the role of that in alienating potential conservative Christian Democratic voters who are disillusioned with the Republicans. And in particular, I mean that at the very same time that the Republican Party adopted opposition to abortion as a shibboleth, the reverse happened on the left in the United States. And it became essentially impossible to be a convicted, outspoken, pro-life Democrat. Now, there are pro-life Democrats. Joe Biden is an example. However, they have to toe the line and say, this is my personal opinion. It is completely settled in the public sphere. I stay away from it. And now I'm not saying that it's not a deeply complicated question. But it would do so much good if the Democratic Party could actually welcome Christians for whom a consistent ethic of life means not only endorsement of democratic policies regarding care for the poor and the social safety net, but also opposition to physician-assisted death and legal abortion. That this has to be on the range of positions that are not considered heresy. This is especially important because if we look at the polling data done on millennials, younger Americans, not just evangelicals, what we see is a kind of rightward movement on the abortion question. Well, I'll say it's the one issue on which millennial white evangelicals are not to the left of their parents. Mm-hmm. They are just as pro-life as their parents. And among millennials more broadly, it's a little bit mushy, the data, I think, but there's been a slight shift to the right. And I think this is because younger women did not live through second wave feminism. They didn't fight those battles. Therefore, the argument that this is all about the control of a woman should have over her own body, it doesn't resonate in the same mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. And they, I think, are more inclined to give some credence to the conservative characterization of abortion. I also think, honestly, ultrasound technology and advances like this have really troubled any effort to make this a simple matter, you know, and the viability of a very, very young fetuses and so forth. So that's the complexity of that is one that Democrats have failed to grapple with, and it has political consequences. I also think that the Democratic Party has become totally captive to identity politics, to advancing cultural acceptance and rights for segments of their constituencies. I fully endorse the moral gravity of the oppression and suffering experienced by non-heterosexual people, by non-white people. Absolutely. However, to slice and dice the community and encourage one's supporters to close ranks and refuse to admit that anyone who doesn't look like them or have a sex life like them can possibly have any common ground or understand their experience is to stop the project of coalition building before it can even start. And I'm desperate for some recovery of the sort of old left class consciousness. Now, that's much harder to achieve in America for all kinds of historical and cultural reasons than it is in many of our peer countries. But, you know, and then there are hints that it's coming back. I mean, Bernie Sanders had this kind of unexpected momentum, although he was widely criticized for not getting the identity politics piece of the American left. And that's one explanation for his failure, among others. But I think there is, among especially younger evangelicals, a little bit more free thinking about how to solve some of these problems of social inequality. They are encountering more Christians from other countries. Many of these Christian liberal arts schools are quite interesting. I mean, they have missionary kids. They've got these international students who are very conservative on the culture issues, on sexuality and gender roles. But often, they are social gospelers. And of course, you know, in Canada, the social gospel has this much more mainstream institutionalized fate than it has had in the United States. And I think as some of the parochialism falls away from younger conservative Christians, there's an opportunity that the Democrats could capitalize on if they minimized slightly some of the identitarian ways of thinking.
Do you not also think that the folks on the left and the progressive side need to become religiously literate? They need to come to a place where they're no longer simply comfortable blowing off devout religious people as if there's nothing to be considered here?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think one can find examples of embarrassing levels of religious illiteracy on the left, for sure. I think there's more religious literacy than is apparent because of the deeply secular idiom of progressive politics in the United States, at least white progressive politics. Take Hillary Clinton. I'm pretty comfortable saying that woman is religiously literate.
Oh, she is. Yeah.
Far more so than Donald Trump. Although Donald Trump, people fail to see often as a very consistent orthodox adherent to one of the great American Protestant traditions, and that is the prosperity gospel. You know, his family went to Norman Vincent Peale's church and all of that, so it's not that he's an outsider exactly to the evangelical tradition. But I think you're right in that as a party, you know, maybe the broader public sphere context, there's still this sense that when Democratic politicians, white Democratic politicians, use that idiom, when they, on the rare occasions, when they invoke religious authority or reference scripture, it doesn't sit quite right. It feels unnatural. Now, the story is entirely different if we're talking about black liberals, right?
Isn't that amazing?
Yes.
It's just an entirely different story.
It's entirely different. You know, even someone like Barack Obama, who I think is quite uncomfortable, you know, I mean, his relationship to the Christian tradition is complicated. He's not a conventional, we'll put it this way, he's not a conventional Martin Luther King-style Baptist. He's had to work at it. But even given that...
He wasn't raised that
way. No. And I mean, the story goes that, you know, Michelle Obama, when he was getting started in his career in Chicago, said, "You got to go to a black church. This is a piece that we're missing," and dragged him to Jeremiah Wright's church, for better and for worse. But even given that unconventional background he has, when he speaks in the African American pastoral oratorical tradition, it scans as completely genuine and authentic. And it has this powerful effect. So, you know, maybe as we see the rise of more non-white liberal Christian leaders on the American left, we might see a recovery of a different kind of Christian civil religious idiom.
I'd like to finish this part of our conversation by asking you to reflect a little bit on what you see in the evangelical world among the, I think, mainly younger evangelicals, endeavoring to recover history, recover some sense of the breadth of the religious tradition, recover perhaps, even in some cases, a concern for religious community, the kind of new monasticism, things of that nature. What are you seeing taking place? What's the range of things?
I should preface this by saying that I think I have committed a sin that I see many journalists committing, which is that we tend to go out and look for anecdotes that confirm our wishful thinking, or simply that represents something new and different and therefore is news. Because to simply say, you know, it's more likely than not that most young white evangelicals are pretty much just going to keep viewing the world the way their parents do. Nothing to see here. Move along. It's not news. And I think...
So when you do that as a journalist, are you suggesting that that is making more of this difference than perhaps is warranted?
I think sometimes we exaggerate the numbers and the cultural influence of these dissenters. And my broad view is that while the demographics are pretty clear and the proportion of the American population that is conservative white Protestant will continue to shrink, that the Christian right as a political presence will continue to punch above its weight, have disproportionate political influence for a very long time, even if the long-term trends are pretty evident. That said, I do think that there are some hopeful and really interesting developments among younger evangelicals, particularly at Christian liberal arts colleges, where I think because there's this presumption that everyone's kind of on the same team, there is a feeling of some freedom within boundaries, I don't want to romanticize it, to really explore the broader reaches of the Christian tradition and think about different ways of being a Christian in culture, learn about, you know, Eastern Christianity, and use that to expose some of the assumptions that undergird Protestantism in North America that are very Western and that are completely tied to this Enlightenment battle with science that we opened our conversation by talking about, and also reveal the historical contingency of the peculiar marriage between American evangelicalism and free market economics. You have some of that up here in Canada, but it's not quite so powerful. And I think that there's a simpler thing going on too, which is that a lot of younger evangelicals that I meet, even if, you know, they're not actually that intellectually curious or they don't give off a sense of really wrestling with theology, it's not where their heads are at, they're just finding it unpleasant to be seen as a bigot, to be painted with this very unflattering brush. They are put off by the antagonistic, confrontational character of their parents' generation of culture warrior politics. And if that's what it is to be an evangelical, don't call them an evangelical. They're not really sure about the theology, but they're uncomfortable with that label. And that discomfort, I think, may prod them in these other directions as they mature. And they are simply, you know, the more kind of alert among them, and this is not true simply of younger folks, this is true of evangelicals in all the demographic brackets, who are paying any attention, are once they get over their kind of shock and anger at the sense of losing control of the country, they come to a point of accepting that Christianity is going to be it is increasingly a moral minority. So, you know, I had a really interesting conversation with a guy named Russell Moore, who's a prominent leader in the Southern Baptist world and also a notable opponent of Donald Trump. And he talks in terms of a prophetic minority, conservative Christians have to stop trying to reconquer the culture, and they have to think about their witness in a different way. And his term for that is thinking in terms of being a prophetic mm-hmm. minority. It's not quietism. It's right. not the Benedict option.
Right.
But it's something in between.
I know a number of people who were raised evangelicals and who claimed that tradition for a period of time, who became deeply uncomfortable with being seen as bigots. And their trajectory, at least in some of these cases, has been to just leave the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's another...
Yeah, and they don't go to a liberal church. They just leave the church.
No, they just leave. Yeah. And that also struck me as a real tragedy.
Oh, you'll love this. I had this student last year who grew up in a very fundamentalist, kind of restorationist Christian Churches of Christ home in the American South in North Carolina. And he kind of reasoned his way through the scientific claims of evolution alongside the claims of his own tradition, found evolution more convincing, but found liberal Christianity just squishy and totally unappealing and no way. It was sort of an all or nothing question. Then he took my class in intellectual history, and they had to write an intellectual autobiography in which he recounted this, and then they had to write an intellectual biography for their final paper. And he chose Paul Tillich.
Ah.
And part of his thinking, growing out of some conversations he and I had had, was he hadn't really given quote-unquote liberal Christianity a fair shake. And that it wasn't all, you know, rainbow stoles and guitars. There might be more to it. And I think his sojourn with Professor Tillich over the course of a semester opened his eyes to the depth that is there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I'm going to keep track of him, but I wonder if he'll find his way back to some more moderate relationship with the Christian tradition.
In the last few years, I have quite often had the sense that Paul Tillich turns over in his grave when people who claim the liberal Protestant tradition, when they speak with their complete incapacity to deal with pluralism.
Right.
And I sometimes think they become kind of liberal fascists.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole richness of the liberal tradition, whatever one likes or dislikes about it, but the richness of it in someone like Tillich is just extraordinary and is little known also these days
mm-hmm.
in the liberal church.
That's
so
right.
It's curious. Thanks so much.
Oh, great this to was see fun. You.
It's been particularly lovely for me to meet and talk, think together with Molly Worthen again after all these years. I remind you of her lovely book, The Apostles of Reason, The Crisis of Authority in American Evangelicalism. I encourage you to read it. Thank you for joining us in conversation. I would be interested in your thoughts. Contact information is in the show notes.